At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I am Alex, and I'm here with a very special episode for you with two very special guests, Oni Press publisher Hunter Goranson and Oni EIC Sierra Hahn. Hunter and Sierra, welcome to the podcast. Excited to chat.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Great to have you back, and great to talk about this. Great to talk about Oni, particularly as we're taping. This is not even quite a full week after San Diego. So the important part here is, how are you doing physically, mentally? Or are you okay?
As I have said, I am spiritually, physically, and mentally exhausted, but all due to a great show where we had just, you know, tons of great interactions with creators, fans, our fellow professionals. But every year I go, every year I get a little bit older, every year it gets a little bit hard to spring back as quickly. Sierra, how about you?
Yeah, it's nice to know that I wasn't alone, because by day three of recovery, I was like, why am I still so tired? But it was honestly probably my favorite year there. It was just really exciting. It felt like people were just energized and happy to be there. It really felt like a celebration, not to toot our own horns, but a celebration of the work that Oni's been doing the last 2.5-3 years that Hunter and I've been there. And so it kind of felt like an accumulation of all these things that we've been building toward. And so we got to celebrate that, of course, with our Oni team and our Oni family on the ground. And in addition to with our creators and people who are curious about what we're doing and what the road ahead still looks like for us.
You know, this is not to jump too far ahead, because I do want to jump back and I do want to talk about some of the bigger announcements that you made at San Diego. But just while we're touching on it, from a very outside perspective, it feels like there's been a little bit of recentering of the con to focus back on comics. Like, obviously there was still a alien ship crashed outside and all of those things. But like, was that your feeling from the inside as well? Does it feel like Comic-Con is now at least a little bit more about comics again?
I'm not sure I'd go that crazy, Alec.
Okay.
It's the Super Bowl of pop culture.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And you can feel whatever the dominant trends are at the time. When that's superhero movies, it feels like superhero movies. When that's The Walking Dead being the biggest show on TV, that's what it feels like. When it's publishers having, you know, a ton of new high profile books coming out of the gate, you can feel that. So I think the Hollywood stuff has rescinded a little bit, but it's still there. There was a very excellent inflatable Liam Neeson doing splits for the Naked Gun that said "spread 'em, nerds," you know? So like that there's still Hollywood stuff in play. Shout out to the inflatable Liam Neeson.
We're having him on the podcast next, so I'll hold off on any questions about that. But why don't we talk about Oni Press? So this is probably the most boring way of introducing it, but I kind of want to talk about growth and brand identity, particularly because since we talked 2 years ago at Baltimore, Hunter, when you weren't just getting started, but like it really felt like you guys were ramping up. Now you have a full-fledged EC Comics line. You've got the Nacelle verse books going. You've got your licensed properties with Rick and Morty and Adventure Time. And then you have a whole section of at least what I think of as Oni Press's bread and butter, which is the prestige, more creator-driven graphic novels and series. That's, I haven't even mentioned half of it, but like that's a lot of stuff. So from your perspectives, what is Oni Press now? What is the identity of Oni Press?
Sierra, I can't believe we've never talked about this before, Sierra.
I know. I was like, anyone's heard us on a podcast before? We're repeating ourselves. But it's that, you know, we kind of identify as being a little left of center. So if you're on a spectrum and you have DC over on the right side and Marvel on the right side, and you've got Boom kind of in the mid, like closer to the middle, then we're left of that middle point. And then you've got like a Fantagraphics over here or a Silver Sprocket over here. And kind of, we sort of exist in those two spaces a little bit toward the middle, but a little more toward the left. Did you want to add something, Hunter?
The way that is all correct, and the way that we thought about it was when we came on as publisher and editor-in-chief respectively, was reorientating Oni around the way that we had conceived it when we first encountered the company. So I bought all of the original Oni press books off the rack as a fan in the late 90s, and Oni at that time struck me as a reaction to kind of like the excesses of 90s comics. Like, they were doing black and white comics that were still super creator driven. They didn't feel like, they felt independent, but they didn't feel like they were going far into the far flung realms of what we would now call zine culture or stuff like that. They were a continuation of comics as counterculture. And as we were putting together what our plans would be and talking about what Oni should represent, I will say this, which is not meant to diminish anybody else, but there's a lot of comic book publishers out there that you can't, their logos are interchangeable. Like, if you were to swap the logos on their books, you would be like, oh yeah, they're, you know, the logo on the book doesn't represent or mean anything. And for me, that's a fundamental thing about, like, why does this company exist? What kind of art are we meant to put into the world? So those are the principles that me and Sierra talked about initially, were bringing comics back to the center as like a renegade art form in some regards. When I fell in love with comics, you didn't walk into a comic book store to get mainstream culture. You could go to the movie theater to get that, or to the GameStop or whatever. Comics are a space where the ideas and art in those books weren't being policed by the mainstream, and trying to bring some of that energy back to it. Doesn't mean we can't dabble in the mainstream from time to time or create things that go on to become mainstream, but we should be doing things that are artist creator forward and presenting challenging ideas that don't feel like they're feel like comics and not video games or TV shows.
I think that's that's true from our middle grade content, yes, all the way to our adult content.
Yeah. It's a through line.
Mission. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is jumping ahead in my line of questions, but I think a project that comes through on is your approach to Adventure Time, which does seem very artist forward, very specifically. I assume that was the idea behind that, to bring in people like Carolyn Cash, who are better known for Pee Pee Poo Poo, and other folks like that.
Exactly. So even when we're doing licenses with something that's like Rick and Morty, your adventure, where it's like a globally recognized brand, TM in the corner, you know what I mean? We try to challenge ourselves to say, does this pass the interesting test to stand on its own two legs as a comic book? You know what I mean? And with Adventure Time, the magnificent thing, and Sierra should definitely talk about this because she had more experience. We're both veterans of working at Boom Studios, but I was not there at the time that the original Adventure Time books were being produced. But the original run of Adventure Time captured lightning in a bottle by taking a lot of young cartoonists who were super enthusiastic about that property and giving them a chance to work in the mainstream, maybe for the first time. And with that, we essentially said to ourselves, we should do that, but evolved for today's audience. You know what I mean? So folks like Carolyn, like Nick Nguyen, there's just like Derek Ballard, there's a who's who of up and coming cartoonists contributing to those books as Nick kind of oversees it from a writing standpoint, that I've been just bowled over by the quality of how they've come together.
Yeah, I think like those are all creators that have a very distinct point of view in their creator own work. And Adventure Time is such a beloved property that it's just been an incredible who's who of creators who want to come in and sort of play in this sandbox with us. And I'd read Pee Pee Poo Poo last year just before Carolyn won the Eisner Award. And it was just like, oh, this is it's such a great energetic fit for what Adventure Time is. And it's like, how do we make ourselves distinctive? We bring in this next incredible generation of cartoonists, essentially what Hunter said. But
I think you're both touching on this a little bit, but there's art and there's renegade art, and we're pushing on art and we're trying to put art out there. But at the same time, you're trying to run a business. And I think to continue on the licensed property bit, that's something where I imagine that divide sort of hopefully doesn't, but potentially grates up against each other. maybe less so with Adventure Time, where you have a creator like Pendleton Ward, who seems pretty open to collaborating with people. But how do you strategize with that? How do you let the artists thrive and flourish on something like an Adventure Time or a Rick and Morty or any other licensed property, while at the same time dealing with the corporate wants and needs of bigger corporations?
I mean, I think each licensed property is completely different than the other one, and every relationship is different of like what the needs are, not just from like the licensor or the corporate entity, but what the audience expects. So I think Adventure Time, there is an expectation that you can be a little more playful and experimental than maybe you can be on a less established property, or a property that's still finding its footing, especially in the comic book marketplace. So new licenses that we've worked on and have done incredible for us are like Cult of the Lamb. And then upcoming, we have Murder Drones. And these are, I think, properties that have taken people by surprise, that these are licensed that are going to be made into comics. But it's gotten really, again, captured the imagination and interest, because those properties have such diehard, devoted audiences, either in the video game or in this animated series.
You are doing an amazing job of segueing for me, because I did want to ask you about Cult of the Lamb and Murder Drones next, specifically because those are Kickstarter projects, which I think at this point is sort of par for the course in terms of the comic book strategy. But because you are deploying Kickstarter very specifically for those, I know there's a separate Cult of the Lamb special that's coming out, but that went huge on Kickstarter. Now you have Murder Drones heading to Kickstarter. Why are those Kickstarter projects versus just, say, coming out as a graphic novel or a single issue?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and it's one we think a lot about. The cold, hard fact of it is, and I will say this bluntly, and I've talked about this with comic book retailers, is the process of manually pre-ordering a comic in the comic book industry is straight out of 1987. This one aspect of our industry has not modernized at all, with a couple very obvious asterisks. It's impossible to go on your phone when Cult of the Lamb number one is announced and identify the comic book store nearest to you and pre-order the entire series and have it there waiting for you, and they have your credit card on file, you walk in and you pick it up. Any other form of entertainment in the year 20, like, listen to how ridiculous this sounds. Every other form of entertainment in the year 2025, we can do it from our phone. We can acquire it, pre-order it, have it ready to go, whether we're going to stream it, purchase it, have it shipped to our door, whatever. For a myriad of reasons, that's impossible in comics. And so when it comes to a thing that has potentially people going to comic book stores for the very first time, or experiencing a comic for the very first time with a property like Murder Drones or Cult of the Lamb, where they literally have tens of millions of fans around the globe, an audience the size that is bigger than the amount of monthly comic book readers in stores in North America total, probably. What we've decided is the best way to reach those people and spread the word that this thing even exists is through Kickstarter, which, like, we don't use it as a crowdfunding apparatus. We're making these books regardless. For whatever reason, Kickstarter has become a catch-all mechanism for a one-click solution to be like, I can order everything and have it shipped to a box to my house. Now, that being said, we still want, like, and we use Kickstarter as a means for the most diehard 1-5% of fans to get like the deluxe upgraded special edition version of the books. We still release mass market versions. And before any of that stuff is fulfilled, we will still send people into comic book stores to go buy the single issue series. So the first place you can actually hold one of these books in your hands is in a comic book store 6 months to a year before a Kickstarter fulfills. But it helps spread the word to the fan base. And it also serves as marketing. Like, the amount, I don't think Cult of the Lamb was our number one best-selling graphic novel last year. I don't think that happens without the Kickstarter doing $750,000 and getting 10,000 backers. Like, it just helps serve as an overall explosion of word of mouth out of the gate. You know what I mean?
Well, just continuing to talk about the single issue comic things, how much more complicated has the Diamond bankruptcy made that for you?
It's were affected by it, but fortunately, Oni had been non-exclusive for a long period prior to the Diamond bankruptcy. We were always big boosters of Diamond. We think that having multiple distributors is important for the industry. It's just really unfortunate, you know? I probably shouldn't say any more than that, but it's really unfortunate, and it I'm more worried about the impact of folks downstream from Oni. Like, you know, we're in the back end of the top 10 major comic book publishers. So the folks outside of that top 10, your true blue small press folks who are going to feel the implications of this the most, which is bad for the industry on the whole.
Yeah.
I think.
To segue into something else, but still talking about Cult of the Lamb, I just wanted to mention that my son, who is 10 years old, actually got into the video game off of the comic books. Like, he went in that direction, which I thought was really fascinating. Like, he saw them in the store, thought the lab was cute, read the book, and then now I had to kick him out of here while we were taping this because he's been playing Cult of the Lamb nonstop. But in the other direction, you have, say, there's the new Scott Pilgrim game that's coming out, Scott Pilgrim EX. So this is a very broad kind of question, but what is the interplay at this point between video games and comics for Oni Press?
It's interesting. I'm not sure that there's a direct interplay. I am not a gamer. Sierra is a diehard gamer. I'm just kidding.
I'm a lapsed gamer.
Yeah.
They're both interesting.
Wait, I'm sorry. Were you actually a lapsed gamer? What did you play?
I used to play. I was just talking about this the other day. I mean, I'm a big Nintendo person, but I did play a lot of Halo.
Okay. I can never get into that. I couldn't figure out the controls. But anyway.
That's fair.
Over to you, Hunter.
Learning a lot about Sierra. I would not.
I know. I got a lot of secrets.
as a Halo fan. I'm not sure there's like a direct overlap. I think comics and games are in conversation with one another. Like, we have some friends. Obviously, we have friends and colleagues who work in video games, whether as writers or our licensing partners, et cetera. And there's something about comics that comics envies games reach and revenue, obviously. Like, it's a massive industry. It's bigger than film and TV at this point in terms of box office. There's however, and I've talked about this with video game developers, is there's a envy from games about comics in that, to use a detestable piece of business bro jargon from 10 years ago, there's a stickiness to comics where, like, right now on the internet somewhere, someone is arguing whether or not Peter Parker broke Gwen Stacy's neck when the Green Goblin threw her off the Brooklyn Bridge in 1975 or whatever. That's happening right now somewhere. Whereas with, like, video games, with very few exceptions, and there's obvious exceptions to this, but the vast majority of them, games come out, you pre-order it, you get it on Steam, you play through it, it goes into your Steam library, you maybe never think of it ever again. And they're not impacting culture in the same way. And there's something about it, whether it's the shared universe stuff, the tactile nature, the nature of just how fandom evolved in comics, that makes comics, like, revisit and gravitate towards our content in a cultural way that games does not have. So that did not answer your question at all, but it's something that we've talked about with our counterparts in games before, certainly.
Honestly, I just wanted to find out if Sierra played Halo, and we got that, so we're good
got
to
it.
Go.
I delivered.
Yes. Why don't we transition into talking about EC Comics, because that line has blown up in a big way over the past couple of years, and I kind of want to look back at the beginning for a second, because now you've got multiple anthologies running. You've got Outlaw Showdown coming up, which is a Western. You got Blood Type, which is a serialized story. But looking back at it, it feels like it was a risk to reboot this line. How did you feel then versus how you feel now about EC?
Sierra, here we go.
I mean, it really started with you, Hunter. So I'm like, I don't feel like you ever thought it was a risk. I think you always knew it was going to capture the hearts and imagination of people. But it grew.
Yeah. I mean, it's my job to have strongly formed opinions about things that could be successful or not. You know what I mean? It's literally what stuff we talk about day in and day out. I knew that there was potential here, but I'll be honest, many people who've probably been on your show that Sierra and I worked with previously all told us that this was a terrible idea that would never work. So everything about this project is not supposed to work. It's an anthology. They're virtually all anthologies. Those don't sell. The common wisdom goes, I was told that unless we use the title Tales from the Crypt, it would never work. That's all that people care about. They haven't published books in too long. This is old man stuff from the 1950s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a lot of countervailing opinions in that regard. I had the personal thesis that the tone and the powerful iconography of just the way that the books look and the way those stories hit in and of themselves could counter all of that. And it's quite refreshing to be proven right, damn it.
Well, there is a look to it that everybody is paying, is homaging, from Marvel and DC to Boom Studios and smaller publishers. And so to be the ones that say like, oh no, this is the real one with the real EC logo on it, is pretty cool to like carry on that legacy that, again, I think I'm repeating myself, but really inspired a lot of people across the industry, inspired these major publishers. And we get to bring it back in a big way. But I think it's for people who maybe didn't grow up on it, but recognize that brand are it's now in coming into it. Exactly.
Yeah, DC's in the DNA of American pop culture. Like it's in Stephen King. It's in The Simpsons. It's in everything that we hold dear. And so it just seemed to me like an unrealized opportunity in a world where everything has been relaunched from a new number one or a theatrical film reboot or whatever. It seemed ghastly, no pun intended, that EC hadn't put out anything new in 70 years, and that if the comic books are going to exist, we should be able to get new EC ones.
I mean, I hope you don't mind me bringing up, but it feels like it's interesting to hear you talk about the risk factor there, and just in terms of bringing back anthologies, because from my perspective, one of the big stories of 2024 was all of a sudden everybody was putting out horror anthologies all at the same time. And I think the good news is that EC has moved past that and a couple of others have fallen away. But were there any frustrations there in terms of like, we're doing our big launch and then everybody's like, and me too?
Yeah, like when another publisher puts out one on the exact same day. Wouldn't that be funny if that happened? No further comment.
All right, fair enough.
You know, what I would say too is like, then we're all touching on something that was clearly lacking in the medium. And so everybody wanted to be part of that. And I feel like we all lift each other up in success.
Well, let's talk a little more positively about the future then of EC. Like I mentioned, you are expanding beyond just horror to have some sci-fi, some fantasy, some Western. There's always a tinge of horror to it. But then you also have Blood Type, which is, I think that's the first time the EC label is at an ongoing story. So where do you, I mean, I know you know where it's going, but where do you see it going throughout 2025 and 2026 as it potentially continues to grow?
I mean, I think with anything, it's like we hope that the readers really gravitate toward it and that they enjoy what we did. This was a story that was in the single issues of Epitaphs. Can't remember if it was issue 3. Mm-hmm. But then that we could launch out of that story and create this whole world was really exciting. And it was a real challenge because you're still trying to tell a 4-issue story arc, but you want those beats that are so tried and true and the sort of the EC DNA or formula, as it were. So it's been a huge challenge, but incredibly gratifying to get through it and see how people are reacting, because I think it's doing well and that people are really enjoying it. And so that, you know, that kind of feedback, we have a letter column, so I actually get direct feedback from our readers. Tells us, you know, if this was an experiment that people are enjoying and that we can explore again in the future. I already have ideas for Hunter on that front.
I was just talking to a retailer, the great Jermaine Exum of Acme Comics in Greensboro, North Carolina, who told me that Blood Type like brought new people into the store to get the EC books in a way that even the launch didn't. So just, you know, the train keeps moving. Our dedication is to keep the quality of these things exceedingly high, or as high as we possibly can, and not like oversaturate the market. Truth be told, me and Sierra and the Gaines family could split off right now and probably do nothing but make EC comics and have a pretty successful go of it. But, you know, we want to make sure that we're doing justice to what the EC logo represents, which is literally the highest quality comics ever made. So, you know, big shoes to fill there, no doubt, but we're having fun doing it. And part of the fun with working on EC too is just trying to not make everything horror and science fiction all the time and get back to some of those other genres or new genres that EC dabbled. They had a pirate comic, Alex. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's have some fun with some off-kilter genres from time to time. So we'll be doing that. Outlaw Showdown is the Western special we're doing, and then we're going to rotate into some different cool genres like that that may not seem super obvious at first blush, occasionally, with every two or three times a year.
I want to ask you about one of the other San Diego Comic-Con announcements, which was Yuletide, a book that you're putting out later in the year. But before the panel at San Diego Comic-Con, it was announced it was in development or is in development as a movie. This sort of thing used to happen all the time. Like every press release I would get before Comic-Con is this is going to be a movie. This is going to be a movie. This is going to be a movie. I think this was the only one that I got this year. Maybe I just didn't receive some other ones, but I guess since that was a little less so this year, what part of the puzzle is the feeder to Hollywood from Oni? Or is it really just thinking about the comics first? And if it works for Hollywood, it works for Hollywood.
It really is the comics first. And I know that there are other, I'll be blunt. There's other companies out there that say it and don't mean it. We really do mean it is the comics first. Part of what we're dealing with, and it's mostly to the benefit of the comics medium right now, is for all of, as I'm sure you followed on the show in various capacities, as it's glanced up against the world of comics, since 2020, the worlds of theatrical feature films, streaming, and television have been like in a pretty active state of a disruption, I think it would be charitable to say. Just lots of problems going on in those industries. And that's opened up a lot of talent who otherwise would be writing TV shows or feature films to come work in comics, where we don't talk about making things for 5 or 6 or 7 years before we decide not to do it. Like we do in movies, we make stuff and we are making it now. And so that's opened up the doors for a lot of creators who otherwise would have been tied up working on a reboot of some 70s movie or whatever to come do a new comic. And that's how we found George Northey, who created Yuletide, who's a television guy, an extremely talented writer, came in with this incredibly fun idea to essentially do a Christmas Hocus Pocus. And we were like, this is a perfect comic. Let's do this. George also has another pitch that I can't talk about yet behind this. That was one of the coolest things I've ever been pitched in my entire life that will be out next year. So I do mean it when I say we are a comics first thing. Entertainment is a part of the business. Like, it's just those two, our two worlds have come so close together that they are practically touching, if not overlapping outright. But none of that's worth doing. It's not worth making a movie if the comic book doesn't work first. You know what I mean?
I mean, on a similar bent, I think this segues nicely to at least what I heard anecdotally was one of the big hits of San Diego was Spectrovision's High Strangeness, which for anybody listening doesn't know, it's all about first-hand encounters with the paranormal, but it comes from a company that involves Elijah Wood, among other people. So I guess my question is, do you believe in ghosts?
Do I believe in ghosts? I believe that what we think are ghosts might also be UFOs, might also be Bigfoots, might also be fairies or mythological creatures, etc. I do believe that life is an inherently mysterious and possibly mystical thing that we don't fully grasp in its totality in our highly material existence. So call me spooky, call me a Buddhist, call me what you will, but we're going to interrogate some of that with the Spectrovision books for sure.
Yeah, I believe in all this stuff. We've got great campfire stories that we share on occasion amongst ourselves and the Spectrovision High Strangest team. So it's been really fun to explore together.
I mean, maybe this is jumping the gun a little bit, but so they're putting out this title, High Strangeness. It's going to tell various stories with some top tier creators. Is there more coming from that line? Like, is it a line of comic books, or is it you're working with them on High Strangeness?
So the original High, we're doing one book. It's okay. Five issues. Okay. Each one takes place in a different year. So the first one is in a fit of pique to add a veneer of prestige, because these will be a very nice package books. They're going to be solid content. In some regards, they're going to feel more like a magazine, because they're going to be a nonfiction essay in the back by Jim Perry, who does a wonderful podcast called Euphemet as a paranormal podcaster in each issue. But we're calling them like book one, book two, book three in the classic Dark Knight mold. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Each one takes place in a different year. But you will see by the time we get to the end of it that there have been, let's say you were a four-dimensional being that existed outside of time and space, so you weren't bound by linear causality. Something that happened in 1975 could impact something that happened in 1992, could impact something that happened in the first issue. So we're playing with all of this stuff. That being said, we've already latched on to a couple characters who are going to be introduced in these various chapters that, not unlike Ada the Vampire and that blood type story, could warrant revisiting into their own specials or series later on. So High Strangeness will hopefully be the first of many titles produced in partnership with Spectrevision. And they've proven to be wonderful partners so far. It's the first time they've worked on anything in the comic space, but we're having a ton of fun doing new challenging ideas in a way that we don't usually talk about in comics. So that's exciting.
Sierra, maybe you can answer this one. I think the publishing plan for Rick and Morty versus the Universe is pretty fascinating, because it's an event, but it's a very contained event. You've got the main miniseries, which I think we just had the first issue come out by Daniel Kibblesmith, which is super fun. And then there's going to be a couple of one-shots throughout. So this isn't your typical comic book crossover going through four titles, part 1 through 12. It is more compact. What was the thought process there behind it?
I think it's just an opportunity for us to do something that is like a very clear message to the fan base, an opportunity to bring in maybe lapsed readers into something that is very digestible. Rick and Morty has been part of Oni for a very, very long time. And so I think Hunter played a huge role in this of like, how can we communicate that this is the not to be missed event, and how all of these things work together, and how we can spotlight some of your same favorite characters within this sort of grand adventure that Kibblesmith has been putting together.
Yeah. Daniel has put together was essentially a three-part plan for Rick and Morty. So Rick and Morty versus the Universe is the first part of it. And then there will be two other acts that follow mm-hmm. that. Him and Jarrett Williams have done a phenomenal job. I think what they've done on Rick and Morty versus the Universe is not just fun, not just entertaining, but it's also like really, really interesting and gives you a way to think about those characters, even if you're not like a diehard week to week Rick and Morty person.
To take a little bit of a swerve, and this is going back to San Diego Comic-Con, or actually it's going back to the ALA, I think. You launched an entire merch line based on genderqueer as part of the Fight Censorship Read Comics initiative. Given, you know, the world, the way it is, it seems like rather than shying away from a fight, you're definitely leaning into it or plussing it up in a way. What's the thought process behind this?
This initiative is, look, we're the publishers of genderqueer. So like we are involved in the discourse around what is happening with censorship in America and have very real skin in that game in a way that some of our fellow publishers do not, or in my opinion, do not yet. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So when it comes to, and I want to choose my words carefully, but when it comes to supporting a creator like Maya Kobabe, who I think has distinguished themselves as one of the most important voices as a cartoonist of their generation, whether or not they intended to with the publication of this book, we really do have an obligation as kind of the first ones over this line that's been drawn in the sand in the culture to stand up for the values that we believe comics represents, right? Because if they are, if the forces out there are successful in taking genderqueer off shelves, I refuse to believe that it's going to end there. You know what I mean? And I think we've seen already, it definitely is not going to end there. It's going to keep on pushing. And part of what I think is important about the medium of comics is, as I said, it is a renegade art form. And that is not just Judge Dredd punching hippies in the face in Mega City One. That is cartoonists from different backgrounds speaking up and representing different points of view that are not commonly identified as being part of the mainstream cultural discourse. So Maya has our 100% support. And again, it's not just about genderqueer. Genderqueer is the canary in the coal mine. It's about protecting creativity in comics for everyone.
Yeah. I'm going to have to let you guys go in a moment, but I do want to wrap up just asking kind of a two-part question. So obviously there are a lot of comic books that come out all the time, not to make you choose a favorite baby or anything like that, but over the past couple of years, what's a title that you think from Oni maybe fell through the cracks a little bit that people maybe missed but should pick up? And then looking forward, what's one that they should be keeping their eyes out for?
Sure. The one I talk about probably with some regularity is the Hobtown series.
Oh, yeah.
Hobtown is a series of graphic novels. I have my copy right here. They're beautiful Hobtown mystery stories. We have two volumes out right now, and the third volume comes out in November. It's sort of plays on like Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys meets Scooby-Doo by way of Twin Peaks. and incredibly compelling storytelling, really stunning artwork. The first two volumes had come out from a previous publisher in black and white, and so we repackaged them at a larger format and in full color. The third volume that comes out in November is an entirely new story in the run of Hobtown Mysteries that we'll be doing well into the future. But this is one that I think when people pick it up are universally taken by surprise and completely drawn in. So if you want a good, there's definitely a theme this fall with Oni stories of sort of the paranormal and this sort of uncanny, unseen mysteries. And this really embodies that in a beautiful, beautiful way.
Yeah. Hunter, you got some
picks? I will throw a shout out for my old pal, Matt Luzinowski and Faceless in the Family, which is a beautiful book that Matt put out about 18 months ago. He is hard at work on the sequel now, which we will hopefully announce either later this year or very early next year or right now on this podcast. Matt is like hyper talented cartoonist. He's exactly the kind of person whose work I think we should be doing at Oni. It can seem a little esoteric, I think, upon first glance, because he's actually, we've talked about this before, so I don't think he'll get angry at me. Matt is colorblind. So his work, we discovered that it's incredibly hard to color his super intricate work because he's compensating for color with this amount, an intense amount of cross hatching with micron pens and stuff. So it's in black and white, but just super beautiful. Render some incredibly unique characters. So a very, very unique voice, and incredibly proud to be publishing his work at Oni. We also just put out his first book in a new edition that he did for Ad House called The Freak, which just reissued. Yep.
Well, great. Sierra, Hunter, thank you so much for coming on. Congrats on all the success from Oni, and I'm looking forward to everything. And Sierra, I'll see you online on Halo Infinite.
Sounds good. Thank you, Alex, for making
it. Thank you,
time.
Alex.
KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.